had this epiphany that authenticity was my secret to success, and then spent a lot of time trying out some other things, but at the same time reflecting, blogging, researching. And what I realized is that authenticity is something tangible. It is not simply be yourself. There's a richer definition of it, and that you can take action against it, especially in the working world where it's so easy to kind of get caught up in the inauthentic river and flow. And when I figured all that out, I was like, oh damn, I gotta go out and I talk about it. And here I am 6 years later, still like, you know, Tom Cruise on Oprah's couch, excited, like preaching about authenticity.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode. Today, I am so excited to introduce Erin Hastakosis. We're super pumped about this one. Like, she's a podcaster. She's the best-selling author. Like, I can go on and on. I connected with her a while ago, and honestly, I can just go all day talking about the energy that this girl brings to the table. So, Erin, she is a former corporate CEO turned professional podster, often referred to as the Mel Robbins for business. Erin is an internationally recognized leader on the impact of authenticity in the workplace. The CEO and founder of Be Authentic Inc., Erin is a global keynote speaker, author of two books, You Do You-ish and The 50% Rule, the co-host of the podcast Because Work Doesn't Have to Suck, and Coach Sultant. Her TED Talk was one of the top 20 globally most viewed TED Talks released in 2021. Her talks have reached hundreds of thousands of people, and her thought leadership has been featured on ABC, CBS, and published in Business Insider, Fast Company, Well and Good, among several others. Her company also conducted a national study on the impact of authenticity in the workplace. So without further ado, Erin, welcome to the Good Seed Podcast. I am pumped for this one.
We're so excited to have you. Thanks for being here.
And what a full circle moment to see you, Allie, because we met under different circumstances. Yeah. And honestly, when you reached out, I mean, I know you read the book. You read my first book. Yeah. And I remember you reaching out in that. But you're like, I love you. I've been following you. And I'm like, I didn't even know that. So I'm so excited to see that you're doing great things with Rachel. I'm excited to be here.
We are so excited to have you. And I think that we connected, and whenever I have those calls with you guys, I always try to genuinely like get curious about the human in front of me on a human level, right? And I think your energy just speaks for itself, and it's amazing like what you bring to the table, your TED Talk, like the conferences that you have. You're freaking hilarious. So I'm just glad to have you over.
Wait, can we tell people how we met? Because I don't want to leave them out. Like, can we say, yeah. So, I mean, it's so cool. So last March, I had sort of hit rock bottom with sort of my weight, my back. It was almost turning 50. I was just like, okay, here's somebody who runs, who works out every day. Like, and I'm a mess. I've been in the emergency room twice because my back, I gained 12 pounds. And so, you know, God bless Instagram algorithms. I found a program. Mm-hmm. And Allie was my sales girl. Like, and I will tell you, Allie, I am not easily persuaded, as you can imagine, because my authenticity radar is always up. So you try to give me some sort of freaking sales tactic or something, I sniff you out so fast, and it like totally goes the other direction of what you think it's going to happen. And I remember, and you shared some of your story, which was obviously quite tragic, and you were just very real. You were popping over to pictures, and thank God you were authentic, because it's changed my life. And I know that we're not here to talk about that, but I just think it's a demonstration that it was your authenticity that sold me on a program that wasn't cheap, that was a leap of faith that I had just saw on Instagram. I had been following for a year, and that you never know where people will come in and out of your life. So now here we are on your podcast, which I'm so proud of you, as I said, and talking about all the things. So anyway, I didn't want to have it be an inside thing, and thought maybe there's a lesson.
How
there.
Life works. Yeah, that's definitely. Cool. I love the impact that you have without honestly knowing. Mm-hmm. Like, you have no idea, but that's why whenever I do sales trainings for the girls, I'm just like, get curious about the person that you have in front of you, because they have a story. So be genuine, be vulnerable, so they can be vulnerable with you, but have that genuine curiosity about just getting to know someone. You know, you never know where that's going to end up. So we always like to start off just by you giving a little bit of background of like your upbringings, where you started, how you ended up doing what you're doing right now, just so our audience can get to know you a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, I always like to say I'm a small town girl. I was born and raised in northern Michigan in the town of maybe 800 people. My parents, born and raised there, started dating in middle school. Aww. The same doctor that delivered them delivered me. Like, you know, all those things. Like, I remember later in life, somebody, when I was working actually at Aetna, and obviously we do healthcare and work with providers, and people were talking about pediatricians and how for some reason we didn't have pediatricians contracted in certain areas, and a company was mad about that. And I was like, dude, I didn't even know what a pediatrician was, because my obstetrician was my doctor. Like, we didn't have pediatricians where what I grew up. Like, you had a doctor. And that doctor sat in my parents'. I remember the stories of them playing cards, smoking cigarettes, waiting for my mom to go into labor with me. Like, no. Pediatricians and all these specialists, it's a privilege, and we don't have that everywhere. So anyway, small town girl.
That's so funny.
But I was, I always wanted to do things a little bit differently. And I didn't know it at the time, that a lot of this is retrospect. But I, for example, when I was in high school and middle school, it really started, I ran track, but I was a good athlete, but I was never the best. I played basketball. I was good. I was never the best. Right. And track, I wasn't the fastest. And track is something where, like, you can, yes, you can train, but you can work as hard as you freaking want in your net, you know, like, there's just some genuine things in your body that don't change, right? Like, there's some nature there that you can't. And so I ended up running the hurdles. Now, I'm not even 5'3". Running the hurdles is like the most ludicrous thing you should be doing as a 5'3" person.
Yeah.
But I did, and I didn't really get it at the time, but there's this pattern with me that is, well, I can compete on the usual, but that's hard. It's a lot easier to compete on the unusual. So I'm always looking. So then I went off to college. Now I graduated second in my class, which, by the way, is not that big a deal because we're like 83 people, but I was behind Amy Beckwith the whole way, but I was number two. And so I could have gone to University of Michigan. Everybody knows that, which is mostly people from New York, by the way. I could have gone to big schools. Well, I went to Western Michigan University. Now, a great school, but not a, you know, brand name that most people have heard of. It's 30,000 plus deep. It's a big school. And I don't regret it for a second. But, you know, I went there because, like, hardly anybody else from our school went there. And so I didn't want to, like, just go to Michigan State where everybody, like, I just always wanted to do a little bit different. And what I've realized is that it's just a lot more fun. It's, you know, if you're doing what everybody else is doing, the only way you win is by doing better, working harder. Mm-hmm. That's not fun. Mm-hmm. That's not me. Like, but working different and more uniquely. And so went from there, got an internship with Aetna in their actuarial program. So I was a math major because I was good at math. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And actually that came up because my roommate came home one day. She was a year older than me. And I was like sitting on the couch, probably like drinking a Zima and watching 90210 and, you know, not thinking about my future self. Yeah. And she's like, oh my God, I found it, Erin. I found the career for you. And I was like, obey me, whatever. And she's like, no, it's high pay, low stress. And so of course I was like, okay, that sounds interesting. And she's like, it's called an actuary. Now, you guys, I mean, you laugh, right? Because most people know that what an actuary is. It's basically the most boring, you know, personality job ever. But this is 1995.
Okay.
So, young ladies, you couldn't Google it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's actually, and they're like, it's not cool. So I went to a library and found the pamphlet and basically made phone calls. It was crazy, crazy times. We had to call people and got an interview. And like I like to say, I swindled Aetna in Connecticut into hiring me into what was a kind of prestigious program. They have every year, they hire about 12, they call them actuarial students, but there's our new people in this actuarial program that rotate around. And then you take these professional exams. And so for the next 3 years, I took 7 exams. And I failed 7 exams. Like, I went from salutatorian in my class to literally not passing a 1. Now, what Amy did not tell me was that you have to be good at math, but these exams are graded on a curve. So guess what happens when all the good people at math take an exam? So it gets a lot harder. And so I quit before they kicked me out. And, but the great news is I was at a great company. It was 50,000 people deep, plenty of opportunity. I, of course, was bold and raising my hand for things and figuring out how to do things and had a personality. And so, you know, opportunities slowly crept up and I, you know, got hired for things I was really unqualified to do. And then eventually joined one of the subsidiary companies. And it was post-acquisition. They had just acquired the company about 6 months earlier. And so I knew it was a growing industry. I also was kind of smart enough to know that the leadership team would probably turn over the next year or two, because a lot of the acquired people, they're not going to stick around to the BS of a big company, right? Yeah. And I stuck around long enough that they eventually ran out of people leaving that I became the CEO, which is a flippant way of saying,
let's go.
I'm not sure I deserved it, but also as women, I did deserve it. And so what happened was when I took over, it sounds super sexy, but we were like the laughing stock of the, and I don't mean that actually in a good way. I mean, in a really bad way of the parent. It was an integration gone bad. We had messed up a lot of clients. Our earnings were sort of flat for 5 years. So when you don't grow your earnings, you can't grow your technology, your people, you can't reinvest. And so we were not super well respected. And so people are like, oh, congratulations, like good luck with that. And I'm happy to say over 3 years, I led it for 3 years. I was COO for a year and then I was CEO for 3 years. Our earnings went from 17 million to 50 million. We tripled them. Yeah. Our employee engagement, which is like, you know, the fancy term for people give a shit about their job, which is kind of important, went up 15 percentage points in just 2 years, which is kind of an incredible jump, especially when you have people. We had people in call center. We had about 1,000 people. So like you have people in some really tough jobs. Yeah. It wasn't people sitting around like, you know, the home office. And what was interesting, and so it sounds crazy, then I was just ready for something new. And our parent president of Aetna was like throwing all these things at me, and which it sounds super, I sound conceited. Like, I don't mean that, but she was, my stakes were high. Like I had turned this company around, but none of it sounded good. And I also, this is really important, I think, for your listeners, as much success as we had, and I never had what I would consider traditional imposter syndrome. I had gotten that memo. Like, you gotta be a little uncomfortable. You gotta get over your skis. Like, you're not always gonna have the, like, I had gotten that memo, but I did still always kind of feel like I had been getting lucky, and I was sort of waiting for to be found out. Like, I was waiting for that run, like that luck run out. And here's why. I would go to monthly operating meetings, quarterly business review meetings. And this was back in the day when you're literally sitting in the room with 95% of the leaders, your peers, right, that are running the other businesses like yours. And they were just sacrificing so much, right? They were traveling, especially the men. They were on a plane every week meeting with clients and having steak dinners. They were, my friend Kristen moved her family 3 times in like 5 years to take on different roles. I was like, we're not doing that. I was very settled here. Giving up vacations, like, and in my head, I thought, in order to have success, you have to, like, each time you go up the ladder, you have to, like, sacrifice more and more and give up time with your family and get on those planes and be stuffier. Even like, when I say sacrifice, even like, you know, I'm not that fun loving person I was. And so I decided to retire. I was like, I am just yearning. 22 years in the corporate world, I'm yearning for something more entrepreneurial. Didn't know it was this at all. I did some other things first. This is what we do, right?
Yeah.
But when I went to retire, everybody kept saying, we're going to miss your authenticity, or we're going to miss your authentic leadership. Like every like email and card, it just kept coming up. And I hadn't been called that before. It's not like I was surprised to be called it, but it wasn't like something that people said like on the regular. Mm-hmm. And so it hit me after so many of those, I kind of sat back and I thought, you know what? I wasn't getting lucky. I was just using a different strategy as it felt. Mm-hmm. And upon more reflection, realized that I was literally using authenticity both as my strategy in my career to rise in my career, but of course, also to have results, which helps you rise in your career. And that's, you know, it helped me get the best talent. we're going out on the street. Like, there's this executive that's, you know, approachable, authentic, use whatever word, right? Cool. Not normal, not stuffy, not mean. Like, the bar's actually kind of low. Like, I was actually nice. You know, executives would trust me because I would go into meetings and I wouldn't bullshit them, right? I wouldn't, you know, so many would play, you know, everything's green and yellow and here's everything. And like, those leaders know that like no business doesn't have red at some point.
Yeah.
You always have something that is your it's whack-a-mole, right? It might be your operations. It might be your sales. It might be your retention. It might be, you know, whatever, implementation of your product portfolio. You know, negotiations. We had major negotiations that we had to redo. I didn't know what I was doing. I literally went into one negotiation and I was like, what's important to you? And he was like, he like puked up because he wasn't expecting it. So he like told me the truth, which gave me some good gold nuggets. And then he turned it back on me and I was like, well, I'm interim CEO right now.
Authenticity
was my
actual
CEO. So if I get a good deal, spent a lot of time trying out some other things, but at the same time, reflecting, blogging. And it's kind of
researching, and what I realized is that authenticity
and I don't teach the transparency
is something tangible. It is not simply be yourself. There's a richer definition of it,
and we went from
action against it, especially in the working world,
10%,
where it's so easy to kind of get caught up in the inauthentic river
and flow. And when I figured all that out,
because he like, I gotta go out.
He cared about
and I talk about
me
it.
Having and success, and he wanted to work with
still
me.
Like,
want another schmuck,
you know,
to
Tom Cruise on Oprah's couch, excited, like preaching
so
about
all that to say,
that's awesome.
That is such
that's
a cool story.
That's a cool story. Yeah, from the corporate world to doing what you do today, like it's such a huge, like, difference.
And I'm imagining, like, in the days that you were in your corporate world, like, I feel like authenticity is, like, kind of a big buzzword right now. And, like, with social media, people are like, show up authentic with no makeup on your stories. And da-da-da-da-da. Like, now it's kind of trendy. But I imagine, like, in those days and those scenarios, that was probably completely outside of the norm.
It was, and I will tell you, it's trendy on Instagram. It is not still trendy in the business world. At all. Maybe in the entrepreneurship world, but a lot of the companies I work with are your traditional, there may be B2B insurance, financial services, even inside the walls of corporate, you know, consumer brands that have like super cool commercials and stuff. Like there is still so much. So yes, it's become, it's sort of, people have realized it in some aspects. And part of what I go out and smack people upside the head is like, but what about your sales deck and your stuffy town hall and your corporate comms that nobody will read because like there's no light into what people are actually thinking. Right. It's just a bunch. And so that's, you know, I still have a long quest. I can still be employed, but you're right. It was actually the authentic was Merriam-Webster's year of the word of the year last November. So just over a year ago, it was the word of the year. And the year before, it was, oh my God, no, I forgot it. Was it mansplaining or it was something like super negative. So like we've come a long way.
Okay. That's awesome. That's I think it's really, really, I think people keep talking about like the alter ego and the imposter syndrome and all these things. And I think if you could shed a little bit of light into that, because to be honest with you, whenever someone brings that up, my brain can't process it. Like, I'm just like, what's an alter ego? Like, what's an imposter syndrome? Because I think that I'm such a freaking open book that what you see is what you get. And like, not everyone's gonna like me, obviously, but that's okay, you know? So it doesn't really change who I am as a person or how I present myself. But at the same time, like, can you shed a little bit of light in terms of like people that are in their imposter syndrome? Or read this book.
Like, how do you become authentic?
How does it just happen? Because I feel like it comes to me very naturally, but I feel like a lot of people don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of people don't. And I, you know, I think part of the root of it, because I really want to talk about it mostly in a work context, whether it's a smaller business, coaching business, or entrepreneur business, or all the way up to sort of the corporate world. I think part of it is we're kind of taught in school that there is a rubric for success, that there is an answer. My kids are going through right now, my eighth grader thinks it's all a bunch of BS. So I'm like, toggling with the like, yes, I totally agree. And
no,
you gotta do it for the next 5 years. So suck it up. And so we're kind of taught, right? Like you write the paper using this voice, the answer is C, the rubric for this project is, you know, these six things. And then we go into the business world and nobody sits us down and says, here's the syllabus or the rubric or whatever. But we still are conditioned. So we watch people go run a meeting. We're like, oh, they're so polished and they have such a fancy agenda and they come and they, you know, always say the same thing. Like, you know, they make a joke about the weather and then they, whatever. And then, you know, or we go into the sales presentation and we're like, oh my gosh, the, you know, competitor came in with 75 pages of PowerPoint. Like, we got to at least come in with 80, right? And so we're just sort of conditioned that we're mostly, you know, that there is a formula and we've got to watch that formula. Problem is we forget that the formula is actually just, it's connection, it's trust. Mm. It's getting people to be intrigued or see you as a little bit different. If you think about the business world on the external side, you know, if you're doing sales and stuff, it's like, no, they're not looking for your good product or the best product. They're looking for the one that they trust and they're most intrigued and feels like it's different. Mm-hmm. And internally, right, when we talk about leadership and culture, right, it's about simply having people be able to trust you and feel connected to you. And so how do you do that if you're largely like, there's just been this conditioning because some dude in like 1963 had success doing it some way, right? Like, so we've all just been like following the leader. And even out in the entrepreneurial world, it happens. The big part of why I wrote the 50% rule is like, I got so stuck in like, here's the playbook for becoming a professional speaker. And here's like the 82 steps. And like, here's the playbook for writing a book. And I'm like, but all the business books freaking suck. So like, and I got caught up in it, right? Because I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. So right. I'm like mesmerized by the playbook. And then I wake up one day and I'm like, wait, I didn't even think about what the intent is. And that's why I'm so proud of both my books. Like, I was like, the intent is A, to get people to read past the second chapter, because most people don't.
Yeah.
What to do that? We gotta have a little humor. You gotta have a little like authenticity, right? So, you know, how do you start doing it? That's what I teach. So this is really important. Authenticity has a Greek root word. If I married a Greek, we look to the Greeks, and it's authentikos.
Okay.
And authentikos means three things. It means to be genuine, which kind of jives, right? But it also means to be original and authoritative. Mm. And so, you know, somebody that just comes into the room and is totally genuine that you're working with, but doesn't know their shit, like that doesn't work. Mm. Or somebody that comes in and is totally genuine and knows their stuff, but it's the same as everybody else's. Like there's nothing that's, you know, I always tell people, I'll even do it on stage. I'm like, raise your hand if you've been in a meeting lately and super annoyed that nobody's like paying attention or multitasking, and like all the hands go up. And I'm like, it's your fault. It's totally your fault. Mm-hmm. Because nothing's unexpected. Nothing's changing the pattern. You're not doing anything new. And that's a big part of the 50% rule is like, even if you only change half of it, like it's unexpected. So that's the root word. The way I define authenticity is exposing who you are when people least expect it in the service of others, which is the most important part. And so authenticity is actually not about you. Authenticity, especially in a world where you can pick two paths. I can pick the looking good, saying the big words, not getting fired because I'm following the pattern. Or I can do what's best for everybody else. What is best for everybody else? Story, making, you know, talking about a time you failed, doing something unique and, you know, that's neat. I always say do something that's needed, not normal. Mm-hmm. And so authenticity is actually, if you can think about like this is really important. I think your audience is a lot of women. If you can rewire your brain and say, okay, this isn't authenticity isn't a selfish thing that's risky that I'm doing because it makes me feel better. No, it's actually a thing you're doing because it makes other people feel more connected and trust you and gives them permission to do it. And oh, by the way, once that happens, guess what? the results come back to you, the sale, the employees that's retained or that you're hired, right. like whatever you're looking to do, mm-hmm. The project that people actually pay attention and get implemented because you're the project manager, you know, the sales, et cetera. So that's sort of like what it is. And then I have a whole framework that teaches people like some little steps. Because what I say is I don't change people, I change their addiction. Hmm. And so I think to understand that is to understand how I started doing it. It's like, did I just, you know, wake up? Well, no. And I didn't realize this till I reflected and wrote my first book. I watched my father for a bazillion years, first as a teacher, then as a real estate agent, come home every day. Especially, you know, as a teacher, what would most teachers come home? He would sit at the counter, drink his one Heineken while my mom finished up dinner. And he wouldn't complain about kids. He wouldn't complain about teachers. I mean, every once in a while. He would tell story after story about the times he, you know, had a waste basket where he made them throw the paper basket in to do this and all these unique ways that he engaged the kids that made him just loved. And then I saw him transition to real estate in this sort of second career. Guy freaking rocked it. Like my parents are living the life. They're not living the two teacher life. They're living like they've got two homes. They travel all the time. Awesome. He crushed it because I saw him do things uniquely, the way he talked to people, et cetera. And so that's what I'm getting people. I do is I sort of have this framework and I say, I'm not going to tell you how to act, but I'm going to give you these little things to start collecting data and do differently. And then once you have that data and go, they actually listened or they actually smiled or I actually got to see it. Then you're going to try something else. And I give people kind of a tool set. And then I say, hopefully you'll forget about the tool set, you know, after 6 months and you'll forget about me. And then you've got your whole, you know, you're swimming upstream in that inauthentic river in a better way.
It becomes second nature.
Yeah. Cause you reward it, right? It's a classic, like, I don't know, is it Pavlov's dog loop. Or one of those?
Yeah.
Right. It's like, yeah. And you're going to do the thing that gets you the thing that you want. Right.
Right. Absolutely. But
you got to change the inertia. You got to change the pattern, change the habits.
Change the patterns.
Gosh, that is so interesting. Like, I've never thought about
me neither
authenticity in that way before. Like, that definition just rocked my brain. Like, that's so cool. And I could see how that could be so beneficial in every life scenario. I mean, truly, truly. Like, how do you show up and serve the person the best? And, like, that might be different versions of you in different scenarios, right? Like, especially in leadership, I imagine, like, if you're leading one person, you have a one-to-one, like you might show up differently in one meeting versus the next. And that's still being authentic because you're still serving them the best.
You're serving them. Mm-hmm. And to your point about all parts of your life, like just give you an example. Like how many times have you felt stressed or like crap if your friend comes over, especially that friend that always has like the tidy house and they come over and you've got like dirt in the mud room and you've got mail all over the table. And what if you instead think, what a gift I'm giving them. They're going to come over and I'm going to give them the permission that they probably are so demanding to be imperfect, to be messy, to be lived in. Because that's what you want. Yeah. Like you don't, what happens when you go over to your friend's house that's perfect? You don't go, oh, they're so wonderful. You go, fuck. My house is I am a disaster. Like that's all we do. Like what happens when we see Allie in her cute little tank top? We're like, oh, hot damn. I need to lose a few more pounds. You look so good, right? Like, so what if instead you operated under this mindset that those imperfections, that authenticity is like the biggest gift you can give others and they're going to give it back to you once you start giving it.
Yeah. I think it's one of the things that I mentioned earlier in another episode where I was like, I'm just sick and tired of these like Instagram moms having a white kitchen with a white freaking couch. Like, screw you. Not like, it's not real. Yeah. Like, you have another kitchen. Show that one. You have five toddlers.
Bucket of stuff under the stools
It's like you have five toddlers. Like, I purposely buy a black car and I have a black couch and everything's black.
Bar stools.
It's because my kids are 3 and 4. Yeah. Like, but you have 5 of those. So like a white couch, not buying it. I'm not buying that crap. And it honestly, people that fall into that and actually believe that then are always trying to reach the freaking unreachable because it's really sick. Like it's just toxic. And why you have to take
happens is we get so pissed at that, whether it's the white kitchen or the town hall meeting at the corporate thing, we're like, oh my God, I can't keep my eyes open. But then we go to do it, and let's be honest with ourselves. A lot of times we revert, right? And that's why I'm always so tough with people. I'm like, you have this disease where you think you're the only one that wants authenticity. And then when you go to do it, you're like, oh no, but people will want the polished, you know, town hall with the agenda that we had for the last 3 years. And it's like bullshit, yeah, right? Yeah. And so part of authenticity is actually just getting pissed about the white kitchens.
Yeah.
Let's keep
buying a black couch.
But actually doing something about it.
Yeah.
Right? And not being a hypocrite.
Yeah, I work around it. Like, I literally, my house is all black. Like, everything is black around my house. My car is black outside, black on the inside. Yeah. Why? Because I have kids. Like, would I love to have a freaking perfect white couch? Absolutely. Probably when they're out of the freaking house, you know? Like, I just work around it, but I think it's just such BS. Mm-hmm. And again, it's people trying to be someone they're not, which is horrible.
Yeah. I feel like this is like the pep talk we needed to hear, because we, like, literally last night we were in your black kitchen. We were talking about, like, man, we really need to start doing like Instagram stories for the podcast of just like us in real life and like da 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 da. And not that it, like, it's just like, ugh, I don't really want to put myself out on the internet and like all these day to day things. And like, I feel like this is exactly what we needed to hear of like, this is what people are craving.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And I'm just like, I'm a very private person.
Yeah.
So I could honestly care less of what anyone thinks of me, because, I mean, unless you freaking pay my mortgage and give me money for nail and hair, it's like, I don't care. So, and that to this day is myself. So again, I think it's more of a privacy thing for me, but yeah, I think that a lot of our audience would benefit from it.
Right. And it's actually, it's not like us having a difficult time putting ourselves out there. It's like making it a priority, but it's like we're doing it to serve others. It's not a self-serving thing. To your point, like being authentic means showing up in the way that would benefit people the most.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, yeah, we'll do it.
We will. We will.
We're eventually.
Well, and do it your own way, like 50% rule. So let me tell you what 50% rule. So 50% rule is my second book. This will hopefully blow your mind too, Rachel, as simple as it is. So here's what happened. So went out, started talking about authenticity, you know, former CEO, like super, confident in what I did, but I'm going and I'm learning all these playbooks, as I mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to the masterminds and stuff. And I'm sitting in Nashville one day, and they roll out the, you know, PowerPoint red carpet of like 82 steps I need to, you know, build my speaking career. Like, I don't have to go stumble. Like, here's the playbook. And I should have been thrilled. And I was totally paralyzed. And I just, all of a sudden, I went from like, maybe, you guys ever done this? We're like, I've always been ambitious, Aaron, but maybe my time's run out. I've sprinted like, and I've just sprinted like race, and it's like done. And I'm like cramping, and I'm on the side, and I'm never going to run again. And right. It's amazing how much we poop on ourselves. And I don't have what it takes. And these people in this room are more ambitious than all this crap. Right. And then I thought to myself, what if I 50% rule it? And 50% rule was something I had used before, but not in this context. I sort of like revamped it. And the concept was, what if I give myself permission to only take half this playbook? Take the half that feels right, that I'm excited about, that feels authentic to me, feels like it actually works, because some of this stuff I think is a bunch of BS. Mm-hmm. But don't just half-ass it. Bring in another 50% that's my own ideas. Really get to what the intent. Well, instead of, renting a bus like Rory did and spending $80,000 to promote his book, what if I did this? And there's science behind it. There's something called the self-determination theory, first of all, that when we have autonomy, and some say at least, we are so much more driven, right? And versus when we just are given a list and like go execute.
Yeah.
And it also creates something that's unique and different and stands out with other people. So what happened was I got unstuck. And then I went and I was doing some other programs and I got freaking stuck again. And then it took me like, 3 weeks. And I was like, oh, the 50% rule. I'm going to 50% rule this. Right. And then I started using it on like everything I was doing. And then it seemed like everybody I was talking to, formal clients, friends, I felt like almost everything they were stuck on, I was like, well, why don't you 50% rule it? Like I did for you guys. Right. And they're like, huh, what is that? And so I'd explain it. And I would just watch them go, oh, and like not only the permission, but then the creativity. So that happened for 2 or 3 years. And then I started to notice it in the wild, this concept of the 50% rule. So I went to Hamilton finally. I was way too late. And then I went and saw it twice in a week.
Great, isn't it?
You guys seen it live?
I haven't. Not I saw this it on Broadway in New York once. Like, it was phenomenal. Yeah, it was
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Life-changing. So I'm watching this, and you under, I mean, you understand the concept, but Rachel, you understand. Yeah. Like, I'm like, oh my God, he 50% ruled Broadway, right? He took about half normal. They still danced, and they were on a stage, and they had a set, but he did half unique, right? He had a bunch of, you know, Black and brown people playing old white dudes. Even 50% ruled, the top half of them was actually modern. Notice they didn't do the wigs and things like, but the bottom half of their costumes was, you know, in period clothing. He, you know, obviously introduced rap, which he had done before in another, Lin-Manuel Miranda in his first Broadway play had rap, but it was for, it was a largely Hispanic modern day population where you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense that they would rap. Well, he combined it obviously with like it's white really, dudes that wrote with feather pens, which is so unexpected.
Yeah, it's right. Amazing. Yeah.
Right. So I saw it with that. And then I started, you know, every documentary I saw it with John Madden and how he became such a well-known broadcaster. He 50% ruled. They changed broadcasting and how you do that. I saw it. Weird Al Yankovic, terrible singer, a megastar. Yeah. Megastar, we 50% ruled music, right? Yeah. The Savannah Bananas with baseball. I don't know if you follow them, but
they
were a rising team in sort of the, what do you call it? You know, not amateur league, but
the minors.
Minor sort of leagues where they have like the entertainment stuff. But when they really exploded was when they said, screw it, we're going to only play banana ball, which was a game they came up with that was about half of the normal rules of baseball and half were new. Like they got rid of the crap that made it long and boring and they added some new rules. And as soon as they did that, like there, you can't get a ticket. I've interviewed Jesse Cole, who's the owner, and like people are like, you get tickets. I'm like, no, I interviewed him like 2 months before he exploded. He does not even remember being on my podcast. And so what I love about the 50% rule, and that's why then it was like crawling out of me and became a book, is that it's both this thing that helps unlock you when you're feeling like stuck.
Yeah,
but it's also the same thing that's going to make you stand out. So as you think about, for example, apply it to your podcast, which is so good because you guys are new, like don't freaking 100% follow the formula. Because guess what? You know what you have to do to succeed? You have to be better than everybody else. That sucks.
Yeah.
That takes money. That takes time. But if you do 50% differently, think about what do you like and not like about podcasts? What do you think is missing? Like, what do you do your own? I'm always playing with ours. My new thing. So we do half interviews and then half my co-host and I, Nicole and I, you know, rave. But my new thing is I'm like, you know what? I'm stuck in a dirty hockey parking lot at least 2 nights a week, usually Tuesdays, sometimes Thursdays or Fridays. Usually I'll go work at Panera or something. I won't sit in a park. And I'm like, I'm going to have like lessons from a dirty hockey parking lot, like mano y mano, little tough love coaching from Aaron, right? And just something different. So I'm always like, what can I do that's different? And makes it easier for me too. Like recording from my car in a dirty parking lot that I'm already sitting in, that's a heck of a lot easier than, you know, carving out an hour on a Thursday afternoon, right? So anyway, so that's the 50% rule, which is like this authenticity hack on top of like my humans framework that you can walk around and everything you do, just always be thinking like, I hope you too are just like, how do we 50% rule it?
Yeah, that's literally thinking about it and how that transcended, like you talking about this actually reminded me about sales. Like when sales actually clicks for you, I think that it's just this, it becomes second nature in terms of like, you're looking for an actual connection with the person. You're actually looking to help someone out. Like you're detached from the outcome and you feel like if you actually help this person, then I can push forward and try the best of my abilities, I guess, to push them forward. But for sales, it's a lot of script and it's a lot of read here and do this and do that. And I've been presented with like different opportunities and I always say like they would tell me like, hey, this is the script. Because you're new, and I literally, I'm like, I'll look for data in it,
right?
But I'm not gonna follow it because that's not who I am, and I'm gonna suck. Like, I'll make up my own script, if you want to call it that, which is just having a freaking conversation. And then I'll look in your script for data. Like, yes. I just need to know whatever it is that I'm selling, right? So transcending into like sales and that in this industry, it applies. Like, it really applies to whatever. It
applies to everything.
To everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and for you to be like extraordinary, you have to be different, right? Like, you have to be,
yes,
you have to bring something new to the table. So everyone's a unique individual. So yeah, that makes complete sense. It's brilliant. Yeah. It's brilliant, Erin. I can't wait to read that book. Nice quote.
To be extraordinary, you have to be different. I might have to steal it.
Yeah.
That's good. Please do. Please do. That's I don't know awesome. If I invented that one, but you could tag us. That's incredible. One thing I love about you, Erin, is like your insane energy. And I'm sure that's part of like has made you so successful and created this brand that you have. Like, is this how you are all the time?
No. I mean, this is me. It's not an act. Yeah. This is me when I'm talking about something I care about. Mm-hmm. That I understand and then I get. When I'm selling, I'm not as good because I probably go to the alley school of, which is, you know, selling. But I think I do have a zest for, I don't even want to say life, that's too cliche, a zest for challenging the norm, getting people to think differently. Mm-hmm. And I've just been given a huge gift that I allowed myself and my husband and I allowed myself to, I mean, I've given up millions of dollars to do this and this isn't like a sob story, mm-hmm. but like every once in a while I think about it, I'm like, I'm not even gonna do the math, but like the soft back of the napkin math. And eventually my goal is to make as much, if not more, right? Like, but I was on a big track. Like I've given up millions of dollars to do this, but I wouldn't change it for anything because every day I get to be creative. Mm-hmm. Like I just got off a call 15 minutes before this, you know, with one of my best friend's brother who has done videos for me and we're co-creating my next speaker reel. Like I didn't get to do that stuff in corporate America, let alone with friend, with Sean, who I've known, you know, for 20 years. I get to interact with people on stage and off stage and help, like, I'm just, so I think, you know, part of it is just that I'm just really feel blessed for what I get to do on that. That brings out the best of me.
Yeah. That's amazing. Do you have any like tips for someone who might be in a situation where like they can't quit the job, they can't stop being the CEO and they want to show up as their best self, or like maybe they need to raise their vibrational frequency or their energy or anything. Like, do you have any tips for that?
I mean, that is my target audience. Like my audience, my talk is not about like F the 9 to 5.
Right.
That's the like my talk is like, no, you can actually, you know, instead of changing for the job, change the job, right? You have more control over, you know, not all the crop, but a lot of it. And so, you know, little tips, I mean, this is so silly, but people love this one. One of my, I always give in my keynote talks, I always give like three experiments. And then I do broader, workshop trainings where we dive into them a little bit deeper. But, one I always give is change your out of office message. And people are, you know, especially in the corporate world, but think about it. First of all, like 100 people get that stupid message every day because you get so many darn emails. And you sound like, you know, I won't be out of the office. I won't be checking as periodically, right? Like, please contact Joan. Like, same crap, different, you know, different day. What if you just start by telling the truth? You know,
you just reminded me about your out of office message that I got when we first met. Oh.
Yeah, what? I don't even remember. What one was it? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but I'm good. I don't have access to that email anymore. Let me see. It was hilarious. Like, I replied to you, I remember, and I was like, you made me crack up. Like, I hadn't even met her yet, okay? And she was like, I'm in a conference doing I don't know what. Like, it was just like, I remember like me laughing my ass off, okay? And I replied to you and I was like, this is the most hilarious thing I've ever like heard in what was supposed to be like a formal out of office like email. Right. And
yeah, I mean, I'll get sassy and like one of them I wrote recently because the book came out, the 50% rule came out in October, and it was like, if you're bored waiting for my response, you know, check out my book, because I have a really funny book video too, or whatever. So I linked to that. And then I wrote, or you can sit here and twiddle your thumbs. That sounds fun too. You know, like, whatever. But, you know, it doesn't have to be funny. Like, yeah, people might be listening and be like, I'm not that funny. Don't put it, I mean, maybe put in ChatGPT. Don't put something that's not you.
Right. Like,
just telling the truth is like a step ahead, right? Mm-hmm. I'm at a softball tournament for my daughters. I'll be out in the hot sun. Don't get too jealous, whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, most people have some sort of sense of humor. And what happens is, the connections that happen, people write that, oh, my daughter plays softball too. Oh my God, that was so funny. Because yep. Even just telling the truth, you know how many people will realize, oh, we went to Disney last year too. Or we, you know, like I had a client, I didn't realize she was going to Ireland. And I was like, oh, my, you know, so then I was like, I've been to Ireland. You know, it just creates conversation. So that's like my gateway drug, you know, super simple, because it gives you the endorphins. Because you, even if you don't get responses back, if you're like, I'm in a super stuffy, even if people aren't writing you back, I guarantee people are looking at you differently in a good way. Yeah. They're curious. They're like, I want to have a meeting with them. I got to do a project with them. So that's one. The second one that I do a lot is use humility purposely in a conversation. Like, I don't go to many meetings without the first 5 minutes, some sort of, I call it humility moment. It could be real time. It could be making fun of how I failed my actuarial exams. It could be making fun of like how I didn't shower today. But it's not, you have to juxtapose that with being competent. So there's a whole research study that shows that if you have a humility moment and then you smash that together with being competent or a big brag or, you know, like juxtapose those two things, that is the most powerful thing. If you just do a humility moment, you're not competent. That's actually the least. But the data shows that people that do the humility moment and the some sort of, you know, being competent are way more chosen, likable, whatever it is, than the people that, you know, don't ever have that sort of humility moment and are just as competent. So use humility. I actually teach a whole thing called an intriguing intro, and I have a formula for people coming up with, like, it's a humility moment plus a big brag and what's in it for them. And I do it improv real time on my speaking engagements with the audience. I have one, I'm actually going to Arrowhead Stadium, which is where the Chiefs play. Hopefully there are not too many tears on the ground when I'm there in a couple weeks. And I'm doing it with a bunch of HR professionals. And I did it just a couple weeks ago out in Vegas with like 600 women in a room. We do this like workshop thing. So use humility as like your superpower to create connection and trust. And then the last one I would say is storytelling is so underused. When you're starting to write some data, some facts or whatever, like you're posting on LinkedIn. I'm a big LinkedIner. You guys are probably more Instagram, but tell stories. In fact, my whole profile on LinkedIn, so you know you have your jobs that you've had. Mm-hmm. If you look, because Ali, I know you're on there every once in a while. There's like a little, I don't say CEO was responsible for the P&L of blah, 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 blah. I literally tell a story about how I became CEO. Mm-hmm. For the COO, I tell a little story about how I almost said no to it and what happened. Like, so
okay, that's awesome.
That, yeah, right? Yeah,
yeah. So memorable.
I'm on a board. I'm not just a speaker and can go like rogue. Like, I'm on a board of a company, of a for-profit company. But that's got a story too. I tell about why I got excited about joining that board.
Yeah.
The storytelling is just so underused in business and in life in general. So tell more stories.
Oh, that's amazing. I love those like actionable takeaways. Mm-hmm. We always try to end it on like an actionable takeaway rather. So thank you for sharing that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Want to come to a conference?
A lot more in the book. You know, I tell a lot. Yeah. I have a whole framework called Humans. It's the 6 principles of strategic authenticity. And it spells out humans. So it's humility, unexpected, model, adapt, narrate, and spark. And so within each, that's like the third section of the book. Within each of those, I give like tangible examples. So everything from your resume to your, you know, sales meetings, et cetera, how you can actually put it into practice.
Yeah. Gosh, I love that. Everyone that's listening, go buy the first book I read, second book I'm going to buy. Like, yeah. It's...
I'm going to read both. I'm so excited.
I think it's really eye-opening. Yeah.
Well, that's shout out to Allie, too. Like, let's just talk about how authentic. Back to Allie. Has a sales meeting with me. I told you she won me over, which is hard to do.
Yeah.
Sees the book behind me. It was only one at the time. Yeah. And I have others. And just assumed it was a good book. And she's like a learner. She didn't know I wrote it. And then you got it. And then I think you wrote me on LinkedIn like after like a few chapters and you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You're the author.
Yeah.
So, like, shout out to you for being so curious, like, always soaking in things. And I think it's just hilarious that you bought a book because you thought, I thought it was great because I read it. And yeah. then I actually offered it.
No, and I did that all the time. So, you have no idea how, because I'm actually having a freaking conversation. So,
yes.
I, like, Google, like, what are you using? I don't know. Maybe it was, like, skincare or, like, their hair. Or like a supplement, and I would Google it and I would just buy it like live on the call. Like, let me just buy it right now so I don't forget.
Well, you're a seller. Yes. At least I've got, you know, some better looking skin on.
And then she would tell me about it and then I'd buy it too. So, like, anything yeah. she buys, I buy, and yeah. vice versa.
No, like, I will never forget this girl yeah. that got me on Sculptra, which is these injections that like produce collagen on your face and stuff. She was like 60 something. Almost into her 70s, and I kid you not, she looked like 40.
And okay, so send that to me after this.
So yes, so she
wrinkles has just started appearing here.
You get really good at telling people's age, like in the niche sure. that we're at, right? So I mean, I could tell, and I was like, "You're how old?" And she was like, "Yeah, I'm like 60, whatever." And I was like, "What do you do to your face?" And so she's like, "If I could tell you one thing, it would be." To start doing Sculptra. And I was like, well, Sculptra. And so she told me, I've been doing one injection every year for the past, like, I think it's for the past, like, 10 years or something like that. And she was like, and this literally, like, I look like a totally different human being. And guess what? I got Sculptra. Like, it's like, why
and now
not?
Aaron's going to get Sculptra. Yeah. So love it.
Well, non-paid
Aaron,
advertising.
Now we're coming up on time. Yes. We want to be super respectful of your time that you so generously gave to us
Thank
today.
Thank you so much. This Thank was amazing. You. I absolutely incredible. Love this. I'm going to tag you in everything, and I'll definitely be in yeah. touch. If you're ever in Orlando, can you just please, or Florida, message me, and I'll come to your conference. Like, I would love to hear you speak live.
I would love
live.
To go to one of your yeah. conferences. That would
it
be fun.
It sounds amazing. Yeah.
We'd love that.
Love that. Well, I do have one. It's in Chicago.
Okay.
It's not Orlando, but it's in June, and it's not very often I speak at, like, open conferences. Usually they're corporate or associations, but it's a women's conference, June 25th through 27th.
Okay.
It's called Thrive in 25, and there's no better time to be in Chicago than June. So uh-huh.
I can send you the
link.
Yeah.
And
please do. Send that our way.
Please do.
We'd
yeah.
love to see you there.
Yes. Thank Yay. You so much.
Thank you again.
I'm going to take it away.
Yeah, and thank you guys so much.
Congratulations on the podcast. Thanks for having me.
Thank
We're
you.
We're excited to launch this and
yeah,
this get is it. Gonna be incredible. Yeah, this wouldn't be a good one.
Incredible.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Well, thank you guys so much for tuning in to the Good Seed Podcast today. What an incredible conversation we just had with Erin. Yeah. We're going to link everything about her in the show notes. Go follow her, subscribe to her podcast, all of the things. And stick around. Follow us on social media at the Good Seed Media. Stay tuned for more. See you soon.